Hey, you listen to this podcast. Go to myplayvolution.com, click the Amazon icon, bookmark that page, and use it every time you shop on Amazon. It's a way for you to support the show without costing you anything. And it's a win-win-win. Amazon wins because you buy their stuff, and you win because you get stuff. And we win because we get a few pennies per purchase. Win-win-win. What could be better? Come on, do it. Please?
One, two, three.
Hey. We're starting a revolution, a play revolution, a playvolution. Get it? Come on over and check it out at www.myplayvolution.com. It's an online community for parents and early learning professionals who want to chat and share information and talk and educate themselves and educate others about what's going on in the early learning profession. Let's face it, Facebook and Pinterest and Twitter aren't as warm and cuddly as we might like them to be. This is your community. A place you're going to help create. Come on over. Don't be afraid. Check it out. Jump in. Support the community. Be the community. We need you. Got it? See you there. Welcome to another episode of the Child Care Bar and Grill Podcast. I'm Jeff Johnson coming to you live from upstairs studio. I'm here with Lisa Murphy.
Hello.
Tasha Johnson.
Aloha.
And that was just some production value in the introduction that we just did. Damn, the show's getting good. We got production value. I was sliding the slider on the mixing board. It was... Oh man, you should
be here.
You should just be feeling proud that this is a free podcast with that kind of production value. And by the way, thanks for everybody that's supporting the show financially so that we can afford for my finger to reach over to that button and slide it.
Okay.
No, we appreciate you.
Yes, we do.
So we're talking get smart. We're talking cognitive development, the cognitive hunk of the developmentally appropriate practice sexy talk that we had been engaged in.
I love this.
So what's cognitive? What is that, Lisa Murphy?
It's cognitive development. What? It's the part that often gets over-attended? Often in the four domains of child development, physical development, language and literacy, and social, emotional, and cognitive. Cognitive, I mean, as just being very general, this would be your quote-unquote academic. This would be your cognitive functioning. I mean, I'm not really sure what else to say about it. I mean, this would be the part of the four domains, though, the category, the corner, so to speak, that seems to have been given the most attention. Everybody, of course, wants their children to develop cognitively. This is their brain. But it's not just your brain development. I mean, it's the process. It's the thinking. It's the doing of the academics. It's the thinking about the math. It's the doing of the science. It's the understanding of the art and the social studies. I mean, it's the stuff that's in my house of higher learning.
And so if I agree we've been given cognition that abundance of attention, but have we been doing it developmentally appropriately?
It depends on the place.
Because a lot of places I see 2-year-olds sitting at tables with adults trying to pour stuff into their heads.
That mug jug theory.
And so what does cognitive development, when done with best practice, look like?
Well, you facilitate cognitive development when initially you're paying attention to a child's level and their intensity of attention. So how much attention can a child give to a certain task, right? Uh-huh. And are they actually interested in that task? You're deepening and facilitating cognitive development when you're paying attention to a child's memory skills. Can they recall? You know, when you talk about a book that you had read earlier, is the child able to, you know, process that with you and remember what had happened in the story? When you're working with a child or noticing their reasoning ability, their problem-solving ability, how much magical thinking is the child still being used? The methods by which a child is classifying things and sorting things in the classroom, whether or not they've mastered conservation yet. You know, whether when you give a
so they don't
a,
they don't waste water.
So they don't waste water. When you give a kid a pitcher and a cup, you know, a 3-4 year old, sometimes even a 5 year old, is going to just dump that entire pitcher full of water into the cup, and the adult is like, "Oh my God, there's water all over the floor," and the child does not yet know to stop, to pause, to bring their hand back, and to not overflow the cup. And if you're familiar with Piaget, I mean, and now with YouTube, this is so awesome. You can actually search for conservation studies and could watch videos of children doing some of the conservation tasks. And it's a little hard to describe here in this audio format, but a very popular kind of familiar conservation task is if you in front of you as an adult, if you have 2 sets of 5 like cubed shaped blocks. Okay, so I've got 5 cubes in front of me. And I count with the child, you know, how many do we have? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. And then I'll have another row of 5, but I stretch it out. Right, so it's longer of a line, but it's still
more space
between each block, and we'll count them 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and you can ask the child, if they've not yet mastered conservation, which row has more blocks in it, and even though you just did 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, they will point to the longer row mm-hmm. and say this one has more blocks in it. I think it's quite fascinating. From my geeky science brain loves to watch children engaged in these kinds of tests. How is the child's planning and reflection ability? Are they able to think about what they might want to do next? Are they able to process with you, you know, conversations about, tell me what you did today? And all of this leads to higher levels of thinking and self-regulation, which is a topic that, or a concept anyway, that's come up the last couple of times mm-hmm. that we've spoken. And what I find interesting from the data, not only just the data and the research that's out there, but then also the Developmentally Appropriate Practice book itself, is that reminder that self-regulation, not IQ. Okay, so it's not your IQ score, but it's your level of self-regulation that actually predicts your future math and reading success. I think that's kind of fascinating.
That is kind of fascinating, but break it down.
Do you want to know what self-regulation is?
For our listeners, what?
Well, self-regulation is by definition a child's ability to gain control of their body, to manage their emotions, and to maintain focus and attention. So when a child is able to put their own need on pause to keep the drama that's unfolding in the dramatic play center going. You know, I want to be the baby kitty, but right now everybody's dogs. And so if I want to keep this play going, I'm going to have to be a dog. So I'm going to pause my initial need or desire in order to keep this going shows a very high level of self-regulation. If I can wait for something, if I can kind of manage myself in order to be a part of this group or this thing that's unfolding in front of me, would be an indicator of self-regulation.
If you cannot eat the marshmallows.
If you cannot eat the marshmallows. You've been really kind of locked on that test.
I like the marshmallows. I've been thinking about marshmallows. Just maybe a jar of marshmallow fluff.
Well, tell the folks who are just joining us, because it's an important study for ECE people to be familiar with.
Just go back and listen a couple episodes ago to the Playful Learning episode 126. We'll talk about marshmallows. And if you want to watch video, just go to YouTube and Google marshmallow study, and you'll see marshmallows and you'll see cookies. And it's fun watching kids.
It's fun watching children, how children will manage themselves.
And later tonight, we may video this with Lisa Murphy and a shot of scotch.
And if I don't drink it while you're gone, then I get two shots when you come back.
That's right. And so just read that again, though, about
self-regulation defined.
About the research bit that you read before that.
That self-regulation, not IQ. A child's level of self-regulation, their ability to self-regulate, is actually what predicts future reading and math success.
And so
not their IQ.
Not their IQ. And so I think that's real important that we break that down a little bit. And thank you for doing that. So that ability to I have to wait for my friends to come back down to the kitchen.
I have to wait. Yes.
Oh,
you're talking about grandbaby.
Grandbaby, yeah.
Yeah, that's been hard. And there have been, you know, she's 2.5. And there's a couple of times while we've been podcasting that you can tell she was reaching her threshold of what she was able to
and maybe
accomplish.
Surpassing it. And
yes.
Grandbaby just cries when Lisa leaves and comes up to podcast. And Lisa has broken the heart of my grandbaby so many times the last couple of days. But because she's just on the threshold of being at an age where she's just starting to, well, it's been going on for a long time, but she's just starting, she's getting better at managing that. But it's going to take another year or two or more before it's something that she's.
Well, she's probably only just recently come out of the stage of even realizing that we're still in the house when we come upstairs.
Well, yeah, yeah.
You know, that you're actually still here. I just don't get to be a part of it. You know, but last year would have been, or maybe the year, maybe not last year, she's a little older, but, you know, for those of you who work with infants and toddlers, or infants anyway, you know, the mama walks out and it's like out of sight, out of mind. I don't got no mama no more. You know, she's gone. And then she comes back and it's like, oh, she's back. but in really, I didn't really kind of realize that you were gone. So, but that's a different podcast.
And so can you rush kids into self-regulation before they're ready?
You can't rush them into, I don't think you can speed it up. Piaget called that always the American question. Americans were the only people that he lectured and he called it the American question. How do I speed this up? How do I get them through this? So whether it's self-regulation, whether it's through cognitive development, through it's this stage, that stage, or that stage, only Americans want their kids to hurry up and get to something on the other side. And it is kind of sad. And I think we're paying the price for it.
Get done being two so you can be three.
Exactly. Why?
I know.
There's not a reason that childhood needs to be a race.
No.
It really is a journey, and I know that's another cheesy little soundbite, but it's so true. We're in such a hurry for them to be five that we are missing what's unfolding right in front of us, and you miss it, and then it's gone, and then you don't have memories or experiences that you can recall back as a family that. You know, that I think long-term is what ends up sustaining you. Being able to count to 100 is awesome, but the reality is that if I couldn't count to 100 but needed to count to 100, if I had that drive internally, which children who are self-regulated would have, I would either find somebody in my world who could teach me how to count to 100, or I would find somebody to count to 100 for me because I have that internal locus of control and I can figure that out.
Yeah, and so there's no need to rush, and there's no reason to try to rush. And as we talked about again in other episodes, most recently I think in the readiness episode, our job is here and now, meeting them where they are. In regard to these four developmentally appropriate practice, the domains of developmentally appropriate practice, and not pushing them to be more physically developed or more cognitively developed than they are ready to be at this moment.
And this is the one that has been getting, we've over-focused.
There's been a lot of pushing going on here.
There's been a lot of pushing to make sure that kids are cognitively ready. And as a practitioner, nobody's arguing with the importance of kids having these abilities. It's that we've over-focused on this at the expense of developing at least the other two, at least the social, emotional, and the physical. Language and literacy, I would say, is given. It's what's made that, it's like an even two are heavy and two are low, right?
Yep.
And I think we just need to pull back from that. One is not more important than. It's an equal footing. We need to be paying attention to all four domains as we plan programming, and not just math and science. And for those of you who have actually taken it in upon yourself to read the DAP book, at first glance, it appears as though that the book itself is only highlighting and celebrating and focusing on math and science in the one chapter. It's really only focusing on how math and science are developmentally appropriate. Its subsequent chapters then end up going into the art and the music and the social studies, et cetera, et cetera. But at first glance, I advise our listeners to be cautious, because at first glance, it only looks as though they're valuing math and science, when really they do value all of the curriculum areas. But I think our culture and our communities will have an overemphasis on, even within cognitive, some of the specifics within a cognitive development are getting more attention than some of the other ones, like art. You know, I mean, on the continuum of cognitive, you know, you're going to get a lot of play at the math end and probably not a lot down over at the social studies and on the art realm. And you can even see that reflected in what we're testing for. Mm-hmm. You know, our belief about testing aside for a minute, you know, we're only testing right now on math and language and literacy. Mm-hmm. That's it. Mm-hmm. So at first glance, it's saying that these are the things that we value. And there's so much more.
Yeah. And the other thing about with all that extra attention and all the extra resources being put into cognitive, the reality is we're not doing a good job at it. So not only are those other domains getting ignored, the ones we're focusing on, we're not focusing on them in a developmentally appropriate way. And so we're not even being good at the misfocusing.
And what we're doing bad. We're not even doing what we're doing bad well.
Yeah. And so they all suffer.
Correct.
You know, that just is kind of disheartening.
So if a teacher was wanting to be mindful of increasing the opportunities for the children in his or her program to increase their cognitive development, one of the things that you could do right away is to go back and make sure that your environment is valuing all four domains, right? All four things are represented. But then also making sure that you're embracing opportunities to and maybe we'll circle back to some of these after I kind of barf them out to you, but making sure that we're giving opportunities for investigation, building on prior knowledge. You know, how are we adding to something that we might have already spent some time exploring, that we're valuing and facilitating curiosity, trying new things, being persistent, providing lots of opportunities for observation, lots of opportunities for communication, for applying new language. And this would be something directly kind of on the shoulders of the teacher or the adult in the room, is that it's your job to apply new words to the experiences that children have. How do you start posing questions and solving questions, and how do you facilitate problem solving? And if your program, and please notice that not one of the ways to increase cognitive development is do a workbook.
I noticed that.
Or a worksheet. I love saying worksheet, worksheets, flashcards. Not one of them says make sure they sit down and know all of their colors. And I don't know, maybe you got some input or commentary on that.
Let's start at the top again. I want to...
So embracing opportunities for investigation.
What's that look like? Hey, look at this thing. Let's figure it out.
Yeah, investigating.
Having a chunk of time to be able to.
Hey, where'd the chicken feet
take
go?
Where'd the chicken feet go?
They're over on the shelf. I got tired of looking at them. Sorry.
Such things as investigating chicken feet.
Chicken feet.
That flower or that dead bug or that this or that. I mean.
Yeah, I mean, even just looking at the word investigate, to me that means explore, that means examine. So, you know, somebody might walk. One of the things I used to do when I was still in the classroom and traveling on the road doing workshops is I would intentionally try and find something unique to where I was, and I would bring it back for the kids. So like that, they would be walking in, oh, Miss Lisa's back. And I'd be like, check out what I found. Mm-hmm. And when I was in Northern California, a while back, anyway, neither here nor there. They have pine cones, and if you've not experienced this your own self, I can describe it all day long. Their pine cones they're bigger than my head.
It's like bigger than coconut.
Bigger than a coconut. Yeah. They're like watermelon-sized pine cones that fall off of trees. And I brought back like six of them, and I just put them on the middle of the table with magnifying glasses, mm-hmm, and with a scale and with you know paper and pens and stuff like that, and providing the time to investigate, to look at, to see what might be on the other side, and to give up the need to be the boss of thinking that I, because I'm bigger, know what's going to be on the other side of this investigation.
Those pine cones, my uncle's Chip and Dale were killed by one of those falling out of a tree.
Oh, my God.
I think he's kidding. Chip and Dale, you're a chipmunk?
Yes, I am. Hadn't you noticed? So there, and that doesn't have to be anything more formal than what you just described.
It really doesn't. And I think we've mentioned this the last couple of weeks is we overthink things.
And and
our
implementation often tends to be much more complicated than it has to be.
Yep. And our good intentions lead to overthinking, building on prior knowledge. So if I've been observing in the classroom and I've noticed that somebody has mastered something, and you might need to help me think of an example after I tell you where I'm going to go. If I've noticed that so-and-so has mastered this over here, it's my job to put then in the perimeter or the periphery of that thing maybe something that's going to add to it. So not only might it be a physical adding to of like you've done this, now you're ready for this, and then you're ready for that. It could also be language development. You know, you've mastered this. How do I add to bring it? In some educational theories, it's called the upward spiral. Like the upward spiral of curriculum, the upward spiral of development. So down at the bottom, if you can imagine a corkscrew going backwards, down at the bottom, you know, we've all kind of mastered this, whatever that might be. And now it's my job to take you up to that next layer, and we hang out there for a little bit. And then on the very next week, we might come back down and remind ourselves that we still know how to do this. And now we come back up again, and now I'm ready for
my, my example again. Most of my examples are grandbaby based lately, but grandbaby loves helping cook. And so there are tasks that she's been able to help with, and there are things that she's not ready to do yet. And so I think you see that spiral there, that okay, you've been paying attention, you've been helping with this, and now try this new thing, and then you just build upon what you did.
And reminding ourselves that a child will go back and remind themselves that they still know how to do things. So it's important for practitioners to remember that that's not always a true regression the way we might have a definition or understanding of regression. It's the child going back and reminding myself, I still know how to do this. And sometimes that apparent regression is then followed by a developmental jump.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and that's what this is.
Yeah, and some of the stuff they do it with an adult or they'll do it in real time, but then they'll go off on their own and they'll practice these things on their own. Grandbaby, she'll help mom cook, but then we saw it when we were making dinner.
Lisa was making dinner.
No, I did that one thing. I held the towel when you poured something.
He did. He held the towel,
technically,
everybody.
Technically, I helped. But no, she'd been actually helping actual prepare something and had done some stirring. But then over on the table, she was mixing and pouring and stirring on her own and just kind of refining those prior
mastery.
Skills.
Curiosity. And I'm turning my paper over because what did that come back to? Was that social? I think it was. Hold on a minute. The attitudes of how kids are approaching learning. So if I'm a curious person, that means that my curiosity has been welcomed, hasn't been shut down. Mm-hmm. And so I've been allowed to approach learning with that kind of enthusiastic, engaging, I'm interested, I'm motivated, which is going back to the social emotional one that we talked about a couple weeks ago, that we forget that stuff. That appears to me that would be that's the fun stuff. We need to remember that the fun stuff is still under the umbrella of cognitive development. So if there are children in my room who are just curious about the world in general, right there, that is readiness for what is going to be expected of them later. Children are born
curious
and wanting to investigate and wanting to explore and examine. And I think unfortunately too many environments, they squish that inherent desire right out.
And I mean, reading Alfie Cohen, you learn that one of the ways we kill off that curiosity is tying letter grades to it. Mm-hmm. And when we start doing that in the early elementary grades, sometimes as early as kindergarten with the letter grades, we just suck that interest in exploring and discovering out of them. And so like we've said before, we're paying more attention to the cognitive, but we're not doing it better.
Or if the things that I show an inherent curiosity in are never valued, or I'm,
absolutely, because there's those kids that are interested in the
that
oddest,
one thing that's
weird,
so odd. So is that celebrated here, or is it squished down here?
Yeah, and too often it's squished.
Too often it's squished. Trying new things, risk taking,
which is something else that is shut off by the grades and the assessments and stuff. If you look at some of the research, so what's the benefit of that?
Of trying something new? Well, problem solving. First of all, I mean that's the first. I mean, I'm thinking an engineer right now is a master of midstream adjustments. What do I need to change up? This worked. This didn't work. To me, they're professional problem solvers. Mm-hmm. Is how I categorize that. And if your curiosity has always been squished, you're going to be hesitant to try something new because you're going to be worried about what people are going to think, people are going to say, if you're going to get in trouble, if you're going to get your card turned, you know, is all of me welcomed in this space, including my really weird idiosyncratic interest?
And really, in the world we live in, we want children to leave their educations or leave formal schooling with a interest in continuing as problem solvers and as thinkers and as real time innovators. And if they have no opportunity to do that in their early years, they don't turn into adults who are able and interested in that.
Well, and I think that then leads into that, well, we don't do that here mindset. And that's just not how we do it. So you see a child facing a problem and they have some kind of very unique 4-year-old way of problem solving that particular thing in front of them. And the adult in the room has just never seen a solution like that before. So they shut it down, you know, usually with good intention, you know, yeah. Nobody's looking to be mean or malicious, but that's why I encourage our listeners and our audience members to just take that pregnant pause. I mean, unless somebody really is about to get hurt, what would be the worst possible thing that happened if we see where this goes? And just because I'm bigger doesn't mean that I know the right
way. And isn't they probably are modeling something they saw at home, how to solve a problem, and that's how they learn to do it. But to someone else at the school, go,
yeah,
I've never thought
before.
Of that.
And unless there's going to be a bone, if there's a high likelihood a bone is going to stick out at the end of it all, maybe shut it down. But
or at least move in. At least move in and pay attention.
Yeah.
That's not when you go clean the cubbies. You want to move in.
Dial 911.
What did Heather Schumacher share with us? That what are we allowed to say? What one of her chapters was?
Yeah,
safety.
Go ahead.
Oh, safety second.
Yeah, yeah. That's going to be safety second. A chapter awesome. In Heather Schumacher's new book.
A riff on safety first. Persistence. Stick with itness. Oh, I love that.
That's
Carol Dweck, man. Kids with a fixed mindset versus a growth mindset. Carol Dweck, Dweck. For you research junkies like myself, go check her out. We know that children who are in growth mindset will stick to stuff, and children in fixed mindset are so concerned, even at the ripe age of 3, 4, and 5, they're so concerned already with getting it right that their problem solving, their creativity, their curiosity, it's plummeting, and that's scary to me in the long run.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, because they're afraid then to take risks.
Yeah.
They will shut down their own investigations.
Yeah, until you show them the way to do it.
And this is a place where many, many, many adults are. There's not a lot of growth mindsetting going on.
Unfortunately. And then you have those people in a fixed mindset guiding children.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, how do you expect a growth mindset from a caregiver who's in a fixed mindset?
Mm-hmm. Observing. Oh, did you have something?
No, I was just picturing that. Yeah.
Well, everything gets shut down. No.
Yeah.
Observing. You know, you got to embrace opportunities for the children to be observers. And that's not just looking at stuff, right? That's what it sound like, smell like. And we talked about this last week with the sensorial, mm-hmm. you know, using all of your senses when you're paying attention to what's unfolding.
Yeah. And I think also, doesn't that take into consideration that child who, most of the class is elbow deep in the sensory activity. Every once in a while, there's that child who their way of participating is being off on the sidelines a few foot away,
just
watching.
Observing.
And it's not only watching what's going on in the sensory tote, it's watching the interactions of everybody else in the room.
And, you know, Jeff, that's a really good reminder, because we often think that the person on the periphery is somehow not participating, but they... You know, Mimi Shenfield taught me years ago that we need the doers and we need the watchers. You know, we need the people in the stands to watch the game, and we need the people in the game playing the game, and we need the people in the parking lot that they're taking your money to park your car. I mean, we forget that all of those players, so to speak, contribute to what we're calling culture and community.
Yeah, and some of those observers, they're engaged and playing even if it doesn't look like it.
Exactly.
Yeah, our son was that way. Still is. He was the quiet one who was fine and content to just observe. And
he didn't need a social skills assessment survey?
No.
Well, maybe.
That's a different workshop.
And when he was ready or wanted to, then he would join in. Otherwise, it'd be like...
And probably be good at it, whatever it was without having tried it before.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Communicating. I mean, that's kind of a no-brainer, but you got to know how to talk to each other. Yeah, and not just even problem solving. And sometimes I think when we talk about communication skills, we automatically jump to the child who knows how to say, don't hit me. But this is also, you know, hey, something's going on the back of the bus. This is also, please repeat the assignment. I didn't hear you. I mean, it's more than just conflict resolution.
And it's more than just talking, too. It's body language.
Mm-hmm.
It's social cueing and all those kind of things, too.
Applying new language to what the children are doing. So you're increasing cognitive development when you are mindfully attaching language. I noticed that you, boom, using different language, and this might require some of us to learn new words.
Step up our vocabulary.
Step up our
vocabulary. And I think all of them, especially this one, I think it comes to mind that mixed age groups are very beneficial.
Mm,
we've done an episode on mixed age, but because when a child is with other children who are using a little bit more advanced language, have a little bit bigger vocabulary, they're going to pick up that language as they engage with each other.
And when adults are using words in the appropriate context, you know, that's how you get children who, you know, sometimes you'll say, wow, they have like such a precocious vocabulary. And it's because the adults in their world were using that appropriate language in the right place at the right time. So then you get 3 and 4 year olds who know what that means, which is different than buying a flashcard set and saying, reconstitute. You know, that's just not what it's about.
One of my go-to stories for this is we would hook up, well, there, from that hook in the ceiling.
Literally, we're looking up in the studio.
When this used to be one of our playrooms, we would hook up a pendulum, and it is...
one of the children's playrooms?
Yeah.
Not children's.
And we would have that pendulum going, and there is nothing more satisfying than sending a 3-year-old home with the word pendulum in their book. And pendulum is the way
pendulum.
As they played with it, and as they took ownership of that word from physically engaging with that pendulum we set up here, they would notice that in the front entry on my grandfather clock, there was a pendulum swinging back and forth. And one day, one of the little guys came running in and said, "Jeff, I saw a pendulum knocking down a building." And it was a wrecking ball.
Oh my God, that's awesome.
And so they when they experience language and they have a physical experience that gives them connection to the vocabulary, it integrates very quickly and permanently into their vocabularies, and they take that into the world with them.
Well, let me show you that just by that example that you applied new language. The child was able to communicate it. They were making observation. They were curious, and they built on prior knowledge. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5.
And all I did was tie a hunk of rope to the to the ceiling with an empty chocolate milk bottle on the bottom of it.
I had water in it, though.
The last two are posing questions to a child and also solving problems. So, you know, putting out questions. And the only real clarifier that I would put on this for our listeners is that be aware of how many times you're asking children questions that you know the answers to. You know, and there's a part of me that just wants to tell you to stop doing it. And, you know, I guess I just did. So stop it. Or at least be aware of it. You know, and why are you asking questions? You know, what colors did you use? Why are we doing that? That is not deepening.
That might be a good question. Why are we doing that?
That's a great question. Because somewhere along the way, somebody thought that you should get in there and find out if the kid knows. And Bev Boss used to say that you're doing nothing but testing. If the intention behind your question is only to hear yourself talk or to ask a child or to test to make sure, you need to really rethink whether or not that's an appropriate question. There's a really good book out, I think it was Jane Healy, talking about creating conversations with your children. We get in a trap of asking yes, no questions, and it doesn't deepen the conversation. It doesn't add to the communication ability of that child. So asking what we call open-ended questions means that the child, or even the adult you're in conversation with, has to go a little deeper than yes, no. Posing questions, real, relevant, meaningful questions, not what color is your shirt questions. And then giving children opportunities to solve problems, which I would say goes back to investigating. I mean, it's all kind of intertwined.
Yeah, it's but again, I mean, those dancing spiders.
The dancing spiders, the web of connectivity.
Oh, I like that.
So saying things like, you know, asking how many more do we need? You know, it's one thing to say, how many blocks do you have? It's another thing to say, I'm wondering how many more blocks you might need to make your structure. Oh. You know, and that's that opportunity, at least in a specific math example. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if I said it already, but it's one of my favorite phrases is that children need opportunities to bump into math all day long, not just from 9 to 9:15.
So math can happen in dramatic play?
Oh, yes.
And all of this cognitive, I think that's a mistake we make too sometimes. And we think this stuff can only happen during circle time or only happen during sensory play. But this stuff is happening in the block area. This stuff is happening in a dramatic play. This stuff is happening on the playground. This stuff is happening everywhere.
It's happening everywhere.
In a program where we invite it to happen when we create the environment.
Things like voting. Things like voting adds to cognitive development and measuring. And measuring is not just math. I mean, measuring and gathering data and talking to people and going outside and observing and noticing things like ask. Yeah, so I think I'll stop there.
Yeah, lots of good stuff going on there. So what other stuff about cognitive development do we need to touch on before we wrap up? Anything go back to?
No, I think just another gentle, loving reminder that I think many of the people listening probably, like all of us, have felt that pressure that somehow this quadrant of the four domains somehow is more important than the other three, and you need to know that there's nothing in the research that supports that. This is even. It's an even Steven thing. There might be a time in the day where this might be getting more attention, or there might be a time, one particular week, where one of them, but as a general rule, quality, good early childhood environments are paying attention to all four domains within developmentally appropriate practice.
Excellent. Excellent. And now we're going to go back into the vault and pick out which one we're going to get to next week.
You're funny because there's only one left.
I know.
Which one is it, Tasha? Which one is it?
This one.
It's
this
language one. And literacy.
Hey, this has been another episode of the Child Care Bar and Grill podcast. Join us next week where we unpack language and literacy. Thanks for listening. Bye-bye.
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 Bye.
Hey,
bye.
Bye.
Hello.
Thanks for listening to the Child Care Bar and Grill podcast. If you like the show, check out our other offerings, Shots, Lisa's Book Report, and Tom Copeland's Taking Care of Business. And we'd love it if you shared them with friends, left a comment at myplayvolution.com, and gave them 5 stars on iTunes. Thanks. This has been an Explorations Early Learning Upstairs Studio production. Oh.
Chase the blues away.
I'm here,
and now be okay.